cause. Your gallantry is irresistible." By this speech Herod put new spirit into his soldiers, and satisfied with their enthusiasm, he sacrificed to God, immediately afterwards crossing the Jordan with his army. Pitching his camp near Philadelphia, quite close to the enemy, he began skirmishing with them for the possession of a fort in no man's land, being anxious for an early trial of strength. It happened that the enemy had sent a party forward to seize this strong point. The king's men quickly drove them back and occupied the hill. Herod himself daily led out his forces, deployed them for battle, and challenged the Arabs. Not a man came forward to oppose him. They were in a state of utter panic, and even more than the rank and file, their general, Alphemus, was incapacitated by terror. So he advanced to their palisade and began to tear it down. At that they had to do something, and they came out to battle in disorder, infantry mixed with cavalry. In numbers they had the advantage of the Jews, but in enthusiasm they could not be compared, though desperation made even them show reckless courage. So as long as they stood their ground, their losses were few. But when they turned tail, many were killed by the Jews, and many trampled to death by their friends. 5,000 fell in the rout. The remainder lost no time in crowding within their palisade. Surrounded and besieged by Herod, they would have fallen to an assault if the failure of their water supply had not forced them to send envoys at once. These the king treated with contempt, and the offer of 500 talents only made him intensify his attacks. Parched with thirst, the defenders came out en masse and voluntarily gave themselves up, till after 5 days 4,000 were in Jewish cages. Next day, in desperation, the remainder came out to give battle. Herod engaged them and killed about 7,000 more. By this overwhelming blow he settled his account with Arabia and humbled the pride of her people so triumphantly that the nation chose him as their protector. No sooner was that difficulty overcome than Herod's whole future was in the melting pot because of his friendship with Antony, whom Caesar had defeated at Actium. Actually, he occasioned more alarm than he felt, for Caesar was not sure that Antony was finished while his ally Herod remained. But the king determined to come to grips with his danger, and sailing to Rhodes, where Caesar was at the time, sought an audience without his crown, in the dress and with the appearance of a commoner, but with the haughtiness of a king. He kept back nothing, and spoke as man to man. "It was Antony, Caesar, who set me on the throne," he said, "and I freely admit that to Antony I have rendered every possible service. Nor do I hesitate to say that you would certainly have found me fighting loyally by his side if the Arabs had not prevented it. As it was, I sent him all the reinforcements I could and many 1,000 sacks of corn. And not even after his defeat at Actium did I desert my benefactor. I gave him the best possible advice, as it was no use sending any more soldiers. I told him there was only one way of retrieving his disasters, Cleopatra's death. If he would kill her, I promised money, protecting walls, an army, and my active participation in the war against you. But there it is. His ears were stopped by his insane passion for Cleopatra, and by God who has given the victory to you. I am defeated with Antony, and, with his fall, I lay aside my crown. I have come to you, placing my hope of safety in my unblemished character, and believing that you will wish to know not whose friend, but what sort of friend I have been." Caesar replied, "You are perfectly safe, and your throne is now more securely yours. You deserve to rule over many subjects after showing such loyalty to your friend. Try to be as faithful to those who enjoy better success. For my part, I see a dazzling prospect for such a bold spirit as yourself. It is a very good thing that Antony listened to Cleopatra and not to you. We have gained you through his folly. It seems I am already in your debt, as Quintus Didius writes to tell me you have sent a contingent to help him deal with the gladiators. I now, therefore, issue a decree that the throne is securely yours. Before long, I shall endeavor to show you some further favor, so that you may not have lost anything with Antony. After addressing these gracious words to the king and setting the crown on his head, he published a decree announcing the award and expressing with the utmost generosity his high opinion of the beneficiary. After placating him with presents, Herod interceded on behalf of Alexis, a friend of Antony, who had asked for mercy. But Caesar's anger brooked no opposition. He vigorously and bitterly condemned the petitioner, firmly rejecting Herod's appeal. Later, when Caesar travelled to Egypt via Syria, Herod welcomed him for the first time with all his kingly wealth, rode by his side when he inspected his army near Ptolemais, and gave a banquet for him and all his gentlemen, finally providing a feast of good things for the rest of the army. As the troops were to march through the desert to Pelusium and back, he took care to supply water in abundance, and the army lacked nothing in the way of supplies. The thought naturally occurred to Caesar and his men that, in view of his generosity, Herod's kingdom was far too small. So when Caesar arrived in Egypt, and Cleopatra and Antony were now dead, he showered honors upon him, restored to his kingdom the area sliced off by Cleopatra, and added Gadara, Hippus, and Samaria, with the coastal towns Gaza, Anthedon, Joppa, and Strato's Tower. He further made him a present of 400 Gauls to be his bodyguard, as they had formerly been Cleopatra's. Of all his liberality, there was no more potent cause than the open-handedness of the recipient. After the first Actiad, Caesar added to Herod's kingdom Trachonitis, Batania that adjoined it, and Aronitis. This is how it came about. Zenodorus had leased the estates of Lysanias, and he never stopped sending bandits from Trachonitis to waylay the Damascenes. These sought the protection of Varro, governor of Syria, and begged him to bring their plight to the notice of Caesar. Caesar's response was to authorize the destruction of the nest of bandits. Varro, therefore, mobilized his forces, cleared the district of these rogues, and dispossessed Zenodorus. To prevent it from again becoming a base for raids on Damascus, Caesar later transferred it to Herod. When, after an interval of 10 years, he paid a second visit to the province, he made him procurator of all Syria, with power to veto any decision of the other procurators. And when Zenodorus died, he assigned to him also the whole area between Trachonitis and Galilee. What counted still more with Herod was that in Caesar's affections he was second only to Agrippa, in Agrippa's second only to Caesar. From then on he climbed to the very heights of prosperity, while his moral stature increased and his superb generosity was largely devoted to works of piety. In the 15th year of his reign, he restored the existing sanctuary and round it enclosed an area double the former size, keeping no account of the cost and achieving a magnificence beyond compare. This could be seen particularly in the great colonnades that ran round the entire temple and the fortress that towered over it to the north. The former were completely new structures, the latter an extremely costly reconstruction, as luxurious as a palace, and named Antonia, in honor of Antony. His own palace, built in the upper city, consisted of two very large and very lovely buildings, which made even the sanctuary seem insignificant. These he named after his friends, one Caesareum, one Agrippeum. but it was not in buildings only that he enshrined their memory and names. Through his lavish generosity, whole cities came into being. In the district of Samaria, he built a city with magnificent walls over 2 miles long, settled in it 6,000 colonists, allotted to them some land in excellent heart, and in the center of the new town erected a vast shrine with precincts dedicated to Caesar 300 yards in length. The town he called Sebaste, and to the citizens he granted a very special charter. At a later date, when Caesar had enriched him by the addition of further lands, there also he erected a shrine of white marble dedicated to his patron near the sources of the Jordan at a place called Panium. There is a mountain here whose top is lost in the clouds. In the lower slopes is a cavern with its mouth concealed by vegetation, inside which a sheer precipice descends, nobody knows how far, to a cavity filled with still water. No plummet has ever reached the bottom, however long the cord. From the roots of the cavern outside well up springs, which some consider to be the headwaters of Jordan. A true account will be given later. At Jericho, between the fortress of Cyprus and the old palace buildings, he built others, better and more comfortable for visitors, named after the same friends. In fact, I cannot think of any suitable spot in his kingdom that he left without some tribute of esteem for Caesar. When he had filled his own country with temples, these tributes overflowed into his province, and in city after city he erected a Caesareum. He noticed on the coast a town called Strato's Tower, in a state of decay, but thanks to its admirable situation capable of benefiting by his generosity. He rebuilt it entirely with limestone and adorned it with a most splendid palace. Nowhere did he show more clearly the liveliness of his imagination. The city lies midway between Dora and Joppa, and hitherto the whole of that shore had been harbourless, so that anyone sailing along the Phoenician coast towards Egypt had to ride the open sea when threatened by the southwest wind. Even when this is far from strong, such huge waves are dashed against the rocks that the backwash makes the sea boil up a long way out. But the king, by lavish expenditure and unshakable determination, won the battle against nature and constructed a harbor bigger than the Piraeus, with further deep roadsteads in its recesses. The sight was as awkward as could be, but he wrestled with the difficulty so triumphantly that on his solid fabric the sea could make no impression, while its beauty gave no hint of the obstacles encountered. He first marked out the area for a harbour of the size mentioned, and then lowered into 20 fathoms of water blocks of stone, mostly 50 feet long, 9 deep and 10 broad, sometimes even bigger. When the foundations had risen to water level, he built above the surface a mole 200 feet wide. Half this width was built out to break the force of the waves, and so was called the breakwater. The rest supported the encircling stone wall. Along this were spaced massive towers, of which the most conspicuous and most beautiful was called Drusium, after Caesar's stepson. There was a row of arched recesses where newly arrived crews could land, and in front of these, in an unbroken circle, was a stone ledge forming a broad walk for those disembarking. The harbour mouth faced north, as in that locality the north wind is the gentlest, and on either side rose 3 colossal statues standing on pillars. Those on the left of ships entering were supported by a solid tower, those on the right by 2 upright stones clamped together, even higher than the tower on the other side. Adjoining the harbour were houses, also of limestone, and to the harbour led the streets of the town, laid out the same distance apart. On rising ground, opposite the harbour mouth, stood Caesar's temple, of exceptional size and beauty. In it was a colossal statue of Caesar, no whit inferior to the Olympian Zeus which it was intended to resemble, and one of Rome comparable with the Hera of Argos. Herod dedicated the city to the province, the harbour to those who sailed these seas, the honour of his new creation to Caesar. And Caesarea was the name he gave it. The rest of the buildings, theatre, amphitheatre, and marketplace, were on a scale worthy of that name. The king also instituted 4 yearly games, and called them 2 after Caesar, gracing the first contest held in the 192nd Olympiad with the personal gift of very valuable prizes, the royal bounty extending not only to the winners, but to those who came second and third. Herod also rebuilt Anthedon, a coastal town destroyed in war, and renamed it Agrippaeum. So devoted was he to his friend Agrippa that he even engraved his name over the gate which he had erected in the temple. If ever a man was full of family affection, that man was Herod. In memory of his father he founded a city, choosing a site in the loveliest plain in his kingdom with an abundance of rivers and trees, and naming it Antipatris. And the fortress overlooking Jericho he refortified, making it outstandingly strong and beautiful, and dedicated it to his mother under the name Cyprus. To his brother Phasile he erected the tower in Jerusalem that took his name. Its design and tremendous size we shall describe later. He also founded another city in the valley running north from Jericho, and called it Phasilis. Having immortalized his family and friends, he did not neglect to make his own memory secure. He built a fortress in the hills facing Arabia, and called it Herodium after himself, and 7 miles from Jerusalem he gave the same name to an artificial hill, the shape of a woman's breast, adorning it more elaborately than the other. He encircled the top with round towers, filling the enclosed space with a palace so magnificent that in addition to the splendid appearance of the interior of the apartments, the outer walls, copings, and roofs had wealth lavished on them without stint. At very heavy cost he brought in an unlimited supply of water from a distance, and furnished the ascent with 200 steps of the whitest marble. The mound was of considerable height, though entirely artificial. Round the base he built other royal apartments to accommodate his furniture and his friends, so that in its completeness the stronghold was a town, in its compactness a palace. After this spate of building, he extended his generosity to a great many cities outside his boundaries. For Tripolis, Damascus, and Ptolemais he provided gymnasia, for Byblus a wall, for Beirut and Tyre, halls, colonnades, temples, and marketplaces, for Sidon and Damascus, theatres, for the coastal Laodicea, an aqueduct, for Ascalon, baths, magnificent fountains, and cloistered quadrangles remarkable for both scale and craftsmanship. In other places he dedicated woods and parks. Many towns, as if they belonged to his kingdom, received gifts of land. Others he endowed with revenues to finance for all time the annual appointment of a gymnasiarch. Cos, for instance, that the office might never lapse. Corn he bestowed on all who needed it. To Rhodes he over and over again gave money for naval construction. And when the temple of Apollo was burnt down, he rebuilt it with new splendour out of his own purse. What need be said of his gifts to Lycia or Samos, or of his liberality to the whole of Ionia, sufficient for the needs of every locality? Even Athens and Sparta, Nicopolis and Misium Pergamum are full of Herod's offerings, are they not? And the wide street in Syrian Antioch, once avoided because of the mud, did he not pave 2.25 miles of it with polished marble, and to keep the rain off, furnished it with a colonnade from end to end? It may be suggested that all these benefits were enjoyed only by the particular community favored. but his endowment of Elis was a gift not only to Greece in general, but to every corner of the civilized world reached by the fame of the Olympic Games. Seeing that the Games were declining for lack of funds, and that the sole relic of ancient Greece was slipping away, he not only acted as president of the 4-yearly meeting held when he happened to be on his way to Rome, but endowed them for all time with an income big enough to ensure that his presidency should never be forgotten. We should go on forever if we tried to list the debts and dues he paid for others, as when he relieved Phocelus, Balanea, and the smaller Cilician towns of part of the burden of their annual taxation. However, his superb generosity was severely limited by the fear of arousing jealousy, or of being suspected of an ulterior motive for doing more for the cities than did their own masters. Herod's bodily strength was as great as his power of mind. He had always excelled in hunting, owing his success mainly to his horsemanship. On a single day he once brought down 40 beasts. The country breeds boars, and stags and wild asses are still commoner. He was also an incomparable fighter. On the training round, many were amazed to see his accuracy in throwing the javelin, and the regularity with which his arrows found the target. Beside his bodily and mental advantages, he enjoyed the best of luck. He met with very few military defeats, and for these he was not to blame. They were due either to his soldiers' rashness or to someone's treachery.